you would need to at some stage early on in that air assault, if you manage to secure an island or somewhere on the north, then you can start to get your logistics across and do it by sea almost certainly. So the complications are almost endless, and the potential for any landing place that you've actually secured to be bombarded using hypersonic missiles, ballistic missiles and drones is just gives you a level of difficulty, which is something that I just don't think we're used to. The best people to plan this, I'm sure, would be the Russians. Because again, you're in the same sort of situation where we've seen in the Russia-Ukraine war, the change in the way that military operations are done. And so the problems about massing forces, even in UAE, for example, I'm almost certain that in UAE there would be very good intelligence for the Iranians, and they're just far into the assembly points, Danny. So, you know, it's an operation which just looks fraught with an avalanche of cascading difficulties and with lots of casualties. I mean, another good example is Iwo Jima. And people say, oh, yeah, I think I might have heard Lindsey Graham. Yeah. Well, what Lindsey Graham didn't talk about was the level of casualties in Iwo Jima, which is 26,000 overall, roughly speaking, of which 19,000 were wounded, and the remainder were killed in action. And is the United States ready to take casualty numbers running into the thousands in an operation like this? And I suspect that that's something that even those who might be sort of gung-ho about this, even the Jack Keens of this world, might want to think twice about.
And let me ask you something on that point here. And then in the last few minutes that we have, can you talk about what your assessment and your analysis is about what would be the consequences if we go ahead and give the order here? And President Trump, and that headline that Gary was showing a minute ago from this from these conversations he had at the cabinet meeting, he said they better hurry because time is running out. I can't remember the exact phrase, but he said this is like their last chance, something like that. So if he does go ahead and give this order, and there is an attempt here, and military fundamentals and math work the way they always have, and all these other examples we're talking about, and logistic problems, et cetera, and we do suffer a lot of casualties, and maybe we don't even succeed at getting the island itself. We had Joe Kent on earlier today, who is an 11-time combat vet himself. He used to be work for the CIA, and of course, just resigned from the Office of Defense, the Tulsi's group there. He said, if I were in my enemy's shoes, he said, I would let the U.S. troops land and then subject them to all this stuff so that they have to just try to keep reinforcing. I can just keep picking them off, whether they do or whether they get hit on the way in. What is your assessment of the ramifications in the global viewpoint if we fail the way if math holds and that we don't succeed here, we do take casualties? What is that going to do to our credibility and reputation? You mentioned ago markets, they go up and down a lot on impressions, and then other people around the world imagine what's going to happen. What do you think would happen if we don't succeed in this and do suffer casualties?
I think it would be more catastrophic than already is. It's not great at the moment, is it? You know, the situation at the moment is that I think the rest of the world, not the West, of course, because we're all propagandized, but the rest of the world are actually seeing what appears to be a strategic miscalculation leading to a strategic defeat. And I think what this would do is just reinforce that. I think one of the things as well it would do is it would bring to an end the idea that actually the West in general, but the United States in particular, are all powerful, because it would show that a much smaller in terms of its military expenditure country has managed to defeat the United States. And it would tell a lie to the idea that our troops, whether they be Western troops generally or American troops in particular, are the greatest in the world. I mean, it seems to me to show I've got two ducks walking past my, two amphibians walking past my door. It would show that.
Touché.
Yeah, that it would show, I think, that these great amphibious, these great military forces are no longer as omnipotent as we.
And to your point there, Gary, showing this breaking news right here, Iran apparently is mobilizing 1 million fighters, and we've known that they've had that in their capabilities. And you can say, oh, well, they're not very good. They're not poor. But hey, a million of anything on top of their regular active forces, which is around a half a million, that's going to be a pretty tall order to have to do something with on the ground with a few thousand Americans.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a military genius to work out that, you know, two Mews of about, as you say, there are two reinforced battalions in there of about 600 to 700 each. And let's say the first, you know, the ready brigade of the 82nd Airborne, and let me guess that three reinforced battalions at about 2,000 each. So to me, it doesn't sound like, what's that? That's 3,000, 4,000. Doesn't sound to me like 4,200 versus a million or whatever troops is going to work very well, whatever.
Obviously, they're not going to mass all their troops in one location, but that tells you they've got enough. Overmatch anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Now, well, you might be able to overmatch locally, and you'd have to do it using air power because you'd need to actually get to the stage where the air power was actually providing you, making it very, very difficult for any responding troops. I mean, this is what the Allies did during the Normandy landings, and they did make it extremely difficult for the Germans to respond. Yeah. But I just don't. What the Germans didn't have is they didn't have drones, and they didn't have ballistic missiles, and they didn't have hypersonic missiles. I mean, they knew where the Allies' landing were eventually, even though we did have the advantage of surprise. But because they didn't have those opportunities, imagine what it would be like if Normandy, and it wasn't easy Normandy, especially for those on Omaha, but imagine if the Germans had tunable V1 and V2 rockets that they could just fire indiscriminately onto the landing zones. It would have been catastrophic, or the air zone. So to me, this is if it's tried, it will almost certainly be a bloodbath. I mean, it's sort of the rings of, you know, the charge of the Light Brigade, you know, and it's going into an absolute furnace. And I just hope that cooler heads and cooler military heads prevail, because I suspect that the Pentagon take exactly the same view. I'd be surprised if not. They must know what the risks involved in this. So I think the timing issue is about Luke Groman and I have been talking about, which is if the Straits are closed for another 2 to 4 weeks, then the global consequences are catastrophic. And I will send you the link to Luke's discussion. And
that mirrors, by the way, what Jeff Currie said, literally the same thing. The physical market is going to hit bite sometime in the next couple of weeks. I mean, so there's more and more experts making that same kind of concerning, problematic prediction.
Let me give you an example. If you take the things that are exported from through the Straits, one of them is LNG. Another, it happens, is helium. Now, where does some of that go? Both of those go to Taiwan. Why is that important for Taiwan? It's important for two reasons. Firstly, Taiwan has about, we think, 9 days' worth of LNG left. It uses LNG to actually power its factories and its electricity grid. It also produces 90% of the world's semiconductors. So all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about Taiwan stopping, and it's interesting that the Chinese have offered to support them, and I hope they do. But if that indeed plays out as we think it could do, and suddenly the Taiwanese electrical grid comes into trouble, and so no longer have we got the 90% of the world's semiconductors available, then whole loads of industries that rely on semiconductors are suddenly going to be in trouble.
And even if we're talking about ramifications, even as you're talking, I had not heard that's news to me. But that's just got to start adding up to a lot of people. Europeans, our allies in the Middle East, and now even our friends in Asia are starting to say, it's not really good to be a friend of America when they're taking these kind of rash actions, and people are going to have to start recalibrating. Do we need to change any of our associations? I mean, tell me that's not going to happen.
I'd be astonished if it doesn't happen. I think the way to think about the world economy is, you know, our world economy has been a consequence of a lot of it is the sort of capital models that we have, the capitalistic model. But what it means is that it's extremely efficient as long as there's energy, and as long as everything's flowing right, because the just enough, just in time processes means that it's a very, very efficient, but there's very little resilience in it. So as soon as you start to break things, then suddenly things like the things that we assume, which is that, you know, if we order something from China, it will come. Suddenly those things start to break down as the bunker fuel that's available to actually run the ships breaks down, as the diesel that's available.
Right,
so
right.
The whole of the thing is extremely fragile. And I have said for many years now that globalization, which people see as a sort of force of nature, is actually simply a function of cheap energy. It's really relatively
cheap energy, and it works as long as you don't have people being stupid and starting wars they shouldn't start. Yeah. Everyone can benefit. No one, and then everyone's going to lose if somebody gets stupid. And now here we have it on parks. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave it for there right now. I've got to actually show up on a different channel somewhere here. But this has been absolutely fascinating, incredibly illuminating. Thank you so much for showing us really the ground or the water truth for what's going to happen here in the Gulf if we try to do something even more foolish than we have so far. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, pleasure. Keep up the good work, Daddy. Talk soon.
All of our pleasure. Thank you very much, and appreciate you guys too. We'll look forward to seeing you on the very next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Don't forget to tell your friends, the ones that love to listen to podcasts. Get them to add Daniel Davis Deep Dive to their podcast list. They need to know what you know. They can get it to where they already get their podcast. You just got to tell them.